At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
On the program today, what happened this week in this economy and one thing that didn't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the third day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Lots to dig into this week, so we are just going to do that. Dig right in. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Heather Long is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
So let me start, Heather, with you. And I want to go back over a couple of things that Secretary Yellen said yesterday when I was talking to her. First of all, her overall... her overall demeanor, her overall tone about this economy struck me as remarkably confident and hopeful. Do you agree?
I liked your phrase, hopeful. Yeah. I think she characterized it well, that overall this seems a bit like a too good to be true economy, mm-hmm. but she kept telling you that the evidence so far supports it. It supports the hopeful outlook. But of course, the question is what's coming this spring, yeah. this summer, particularly if these interest rates and the Federal Reserve's quest to tamp down inflation continues to ramp up. It was really interesting what she said to you. And I think for me, the only way that this really optimistic Janet Yellen view of the world makes sense is if you really think that we're in a normalizing economy. So the past few years were just so wild and crazy, and the profits last year were just so good that companies can lower their profits a little bit without having to lay off tons of workers. You know, that's kind of what she's arguing, that in a lot of fields, they're getting back to normal, such as restaurants or hospitality right. sector. They actually still need to hire more.
Well, it did strike me, Lynette, that she said, and I didn't follow up in the moment. You know, it's always excruciating to go back and listen to your own interviews. I didn't follow up in the moment, but she did say, you know, if we it doesn't mean people have to lose their jobs. And in point of fact, if this economy slows, it does mean people are going to lose their jobs.
Well, yeah. And the thing is, Janet Yellen doesn't know whether we're at the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end
right.
of this fight with inflation. If we're at the beginning of the end, then her optimism is completely warranted. And maybe inflation will go down precipitously in the next couple of months and everything will be okay. But if we're at the end of the beginning and we're fighting this thing for the next year or two, rates could go up significantly and people could lose their jobs. I don't expect the Treasury Secretary of the United States to be bearish on the U.S. economy in public.
Right.
And it is amazing how far we've come. You know, we went from zero interest rates up, screaming up to like over 4. And this it was like Ben Bernanke's dream that we would have the escape velocity, yeah. the power in our economy to get out of the zero bound, out of zero interest rates without, you know, causing major economic disruption. It's just now we're going through that in a completely different context from what I think people imagined at the end of the financial crisis.
Yeah, and that has people unmoored. One thing that I thought was interesting, Heather, is that she and a lot of, you know, Fed officials this week were saying it. Interest rates are going to go up a little bit and the Fed's got some work to do. But we are going to actually be fighting this thing for a while.
That is definitely the biggest story, seems economically, of the week. I mean, it's really crazy when you think a month ago, You know, no one was thinking that we would end this year, or very few people, with interest rates above 5%. And, you know, now 70% of the market participants are predicting an interest rate at the end of the year of 5.5%. So it's clearly the whole storyline has moved that inflation is going to be a lot harder than we thought to get back down to where we needed to go. And we're going to have much higher interest rates for much longer. And that's not a very optimistic scenario.
No, no, it's not. I wondered, sorry, one other thing that Secretary Yellen said, Lynette, and then I want to move on to some other stuff. But we talked about China a little bit. And one of the things she said that caught my ear, and I said this in the moment, she said, we're putting a floor under our relationship with China. That is to say, we're hoping it doesn't get too much worse. And I wonder if the global economy is ready for the number one and two economies on the planet to be not getting along.
Well, I think putting a floor on the relationship or trying to find the floor puts a ceiling on the Chinese economy and how much it can grow. Huh. Because what we have done with our support of China and the EU and every other country by, you know, having a free flow of goods in and out of the country and all of that is we've supported Chinese growth. And the majority of the country still relies on exports for growth. So that's the majority of the economy still. So if we are not doing our part, China can't grow for its part. And that means slower growth for the entire world. Hmm. So, yeah, this is a dicey situation because this fight will impact all global economics. And I don't know where the floor is.
No,
I find the floor,
yeah, no.
And, I don't
and
know
look,
where the floor is.
Yellen and all the rest of them are feeling for it and kind of in the dark, right? Because it's not something we've been dealing with for a while. Heather, I want to talk about the American consumer. We've talked about the consumer forever on this program. And as all three of us know and everybody listening, hopefully, because they've been paying attention, consumers drive a huge chunk of this economy. I wonder if you're worried about consumer resilience as inflation looks like it's ticking back up and people are getting a little nervous.
I'm hugely worried about consumer resilience. And in particular, we're sitting at supposedly a half century low in the unemployment rate. And yet we already have nearly 25 million people who are behind on their credit cards mm-hmm. and their auto loans and their personal loans. And I'm just waiting for the latest figure to come in my inbox. But it looks like several tens of millions of people are behind right now on their utility bills too.
Oh, man.
And so you can see the fragility. You know, the paycheck to paycheck lifestyle is definitely back for the bottom part of the income spectrum. You know, at the same time, I've been sort of screaming about this for a year now that sort of the have-not economy is back. And, you know, you scratch your head because at the same time, we've had really strong sales of high-end cars and we've got record numbers of people returning to Las Vegas to party and throw big bashes. And so, you know, you really just see that bifurcated economy that's back. But of course, how long can that last if more and more people are losing their jobs in the tech sector and media and other parts of the white collar economy?
Yeah.
So I think the warning signs are already there a little bit on consumption, you know, but I hope I'm wrong about that. But it's starting to stack up. And at the same time, government aid is rolling back. Of course, in March, the SNAP food stamp benefits are back. Medicaid extra benefits are about to roll off. Student loan payments are going to come back. So it's just hard to see how the situation gets rosier.
Lynette, super quick, 30 seconds. What other than consumers and maybe inflation, what's worrying you about this economy right now? Super quick.
Worrying me about this economy, I think people are still when it comes to some sectors, we're still in a bubble. Huh. I'm still worried about, you know, continued damage in the tech sector, continued damage in the media sector. The stock market is going to go to hell. That's just my personal opinion. But if you're not in stocks, perhaps you're not worried about that.
Consult your own financial advisor, as always, when listening to this program. Lynette Lopez at Business Insider.
Yeah.
Heather Long at The Washington Post. Thanks, you two.
Bye, Kai. Okay.
On Wall Street today, I guess they're not listening to Lynette. Feeling pretty good, those traders were. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today is the first Friday of the month, and if you've been listening to this program for almost any amount of time, you might remember that the first Friday of the month is when we get the all-important, but especially critical right now, monthly unemployment report. And you might have noticed that the February report did not come out today. That's because the monthly jobs report is almost always released on the first Friday of the month. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on.
So what is the explanation for this econometric temporal anomaly?
It's a common misconception that the employment situation is released on the first Friday of the month.
Caitlin Harris is an economist with the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the employment situation is the title the Bureau gives the monthly jobs report. There is a reason for this common calendar misconception, says Betsy Stevenson, former chief economist at the Labor Department.
This is one of those things where we all have rules of thumb because they're just easier to remember. So the first Friday of the month is way easier to remember than the actual rule.
Which is, says Caitlin Harris,
the release is scheduled for the third Friday after the conclusion of the survey reference week.
That is the period when BLS statisticians are out in the field surveying Americans about their jobs, hours, and wages, gathering the data they crunch for the monthly jobs report. The reference week always includes the 12th of the month.
For February, that was...
a little mental math.
Sunday the 12th to Saturday the 18th. So three Fridays after that would be the 10th, which is why we're releasing next week and not today.
So does it really matter that by following its rules, this month BLS is releasing the all-important, closely watched jobs report a week later than most everyone expects? Here's Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
In the grand scheme of things, no big deal. I mean, it's a few days later than we typically would get it. In fact, hey, Mitchell, I'll tell you, one data report after the next, it's been surprising and confusing. And so maybe we get a couple of days extra rest here. It might not be such a bad thing.
So rest up. You got another week till what could be another surprising, confusing jobs report. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
At both the state and federal level and across party lines, there is strong support for increasing teacher pay. Laws have been proposed and passed in a lot of states. President Biden called for better teacher pay in his State of the Union last month. Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders in the Republican response did the same. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has the history of that low teacher pay and whether it might actually change now.
Public school teachers have been underpaid since public education started here in the late 1800s. Economist Silvia Allegretto with the Center for Economic and Policy Research says that's when women began to be recruited for these jobs.
Women, we couldn't even get college degrees. We weren't in college. And they knew that they could save money by hiring women.
In addition, Allegretto points out women had fewer work options than men and cost less to hire. That wage gap has persisted for all teachers. She finds they're paid on average 23.5% less than other educated workers who are choosing other professions.
Even ones who want to become teachers often say they're not going to be because they know they're going to fall further and further behind.
Now, as schools struggle to hire, at least two dozen states and Congress have either proposed or enacted laws to increase teacher pay in the past couple of years. That's according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Molly Gold, a senior policy specialist there, says the increases vary.
I mean, it differs tremendously by state, wide range. I would say that there's definitely movement towards the upper end of that scale.
But Gold says it's also important for states to invest in teacher training. She used to be a high school English teacher herself and says a lot of students came to her with personal issues, sometimes related to trauma.
You know, I felt honored to, like, be someone that they trusted enough to talk to about that, but did I necessarily have training on how to really counsel these kids coming to me with these things? No, and it's hard to, you know, take that on as well.
These kinds of experiences prove the teaching profession isn't just about subject matter expertise. And it's one of the reasons why economist Silvia Allegretto says these jobs should be highly compensated. I'm Stephanie Hughes from Marketplace.
Coming up.
I am a level 10 barbarian and I crush foes all day long.
He seems nice, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 387 today, 1 2/10%, 33,390. The NASDAQ added 226 points, about 2%, 11,689. S&P 500 picked up 64 points, 1 6/10%, 4,045 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 1.7%. The NASDAQ picked up 2 6/10%. S&P 500 up about 1 9/10%. You know, all that robust consumer spending that does still somehow seem to be going on? Visa sure does. The payments processor reported that the volume of payments it processed in February was 11% higher than a year before. Visa charged up 2 2/10%. Speaking of charging, ChargePoint Holdings, which operates a whole network of EV charging stations, missed fourth quarter revenue expectations. ChargePoint drained 1 6/10% today. Bond prices up. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 3.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a law making its way through the legislature out here in California that would oblige companies to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions using a single common standard. The Securities and Exchange Commission has floated a similar idea at the federal level. It is not getting a whole lot of traction. So supporters of the proposal out here in California and elsewhere are banking on this state's economic heft to help push climate change disclosure requirements into the mainstream. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has more on that.
If you haven't seen this ad, odds are good you've seen one like it.
To make progress, we must keep taking steps forward. We believe the future of energy is lower carbon.
This one's from Northern California-based Chevron. It's got black and white images of kayakers and a cyclist in the wild, plus a cute baby learning to walk.
At Chevron, we're taking action.
They're greenwashing.
That's California State Senator Scott Wiener, who represents San Francisco.
It makes me sick to my stomach. The oil companies are literally strangling the world with the fossil fuels that they're producing. And for them to market themselves as green is disgusting.
Chevron didn't respond to our request for comment on that statement or on Wiener's proposed law, which he says grew out of his frustration. Senate Bill 253 would require any corporation with $1 billion or more in annual revenue and doing business in California to disclose carbon emissions every year. So not just Chevron, more than 5,000 companies would have to comply.
And then the public and investors and everyone else will know who is actually walking the walk.
The bill would require reporting not just on a company's own direct emissions, but also those of their suppliers' suppliers, and consumers, a category known as Scope 3. Stephen Rothstein of the nonprofit Ceres says Scope 3 emissions can make up the bulk of a business's carbon footprint. And while 90% of the largest corporations already make climate risk disclosures, he says they're far from standardized.
One may be measuring carbon, one may be measuring methane. They have different reporting systems. So it is what I refer to as a climate Tower of Babel.
California's bill goes further than the climate disclosure rule floated last year by the Securities and Exchange Commission, applying to private companies on top of the public ones the SEC regulates. The SEC is reportedly looking to water down its proposal after complaints that compliance would be onerous and expensive. Should the SEC move forward, Public Citizen's Clara Vondrich says there will probably be plenty of lawsuits.
So if that happens, the California rule can be a crucial backstop. And because it's the fourth largest economy in the world, it will cover just as many companies as the SEC would.
California is no stranger to leveraging its immense market power. Stanford professor Anat Admati points to the state's decades-old tailpipe emissions rules, which are stricter than federal standards and prompted the automotive industry to capitulate.
That made a huge difference because manufacturing cars to sell in California with certain standards, that became the standard. You can't just produce cars for California.
But Admati says she's not convinced that mandating climate emissions disclosures will have the same coercive effect.
There's a notion that maybe it's name and shame, or people won't invest in you, maybe divest in you, but you have other people who don't care about it and they buy the shares cheaper. So it just changes hands. It doesn't really change what you do.
Even in a state that's as solidly blue as California, the proposal isn't guaranteed to pass. A similar bill failed last year after a slew of industry trade groups lobbied against it. In Los Angeles, I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Once based firmly in the proverbial basement, Dungeons & Dragons is now very much in the pop culture mainstream. The original tabletop role-playing game, D&D, is now a big part of Stranger Things on Netflix. It's inspired dozens of video games, and there is an official D&D movie coming out this month with no less a star than Chris Pine. D&D isn't really like other games. It's kind of a collective fantasy improv thing with dice rolls. Players create characters, think wizards and clerics and druids, that kind of thing, and take them on quests through dangerous and mysterious landscapes. There's a dungeon master that's sort of the chief storyteller and referee. The D&D economy isn't like other games either. It relies on an unofficial and thriving ecosystem of third-party content. So when Hasbro, which owns D&D, tried to get a bigger slice of that economy, well, Marketplace's Matt Levin is our Dungeon Master.
It's Friday afternoon at Great Escape Games, a fantasy geek oasis tucked behind a Ross Dress for Less in a Sacramento strip mall. Mark Warren works here, or as he's otherwise known.
My name is Gorthal. I am a level 10 barbarian and I crush foes all day long.
Gorthal is a character Warren occasionally inhabits when he plays Dungeons & Dragons. He's played role-playing games with the same high school friends for over 20 years. It's the kind of group escapism he says he can't really get with Monopoly or something.
We're going to get away. We're going to get away. We're going to go to a whole new place, and we don't know what's going to be involved. There's no spoilers, you know, if I'm making my own adventure, because I made it.
That make-your-own-adventure part, that's kind of the magic potion for the D&D economy. Great Escape Games has about half an aisle of official D&D monster and adventure books, all owned by Hasbro. The remainder of the aisle is unofficial D&D books published by completely different companies. Warren opens a beautifully illustrated third-party book about a distant alien realm. Printed on page 392 is why Hasbro won't see a dime of the $20 retail price. Open Game License Version 1.0A.
This right here, this was the heart of D&D. This is the reason why that this whole world, this book, all of it could exist.
The Open Game License was kind of revolutionary in the tabletop gaming world. It dates back to the year 2000. Brian Lewis was legal counsel for D&D back then and was searching for ways to outsource new creative work.
The people that play Dungeons & Dragons are inherently authors. Each one is creating a movie in their own mind. So because we had that built into the nature of the product, it really let us tap into the open source concept very effectively.
The license bred a symbiotic relationship between third-party companies and D&D. When official D&D came out with a product that flopped, other publishers filled the void. But with the rise of nerd culture over the past 20 years, some of those third-party companies started making millions in revenue. Then in January, word leaked Hasbro wanted to change its gaming license.
The backlash was mind-boggling.
Backlash because any third-party company making over $50,000 a year would have to submit reports to Hasbro, and any company making over $750,000 would have to pay a 25% royalty. Cue the angry open letters and the Twitter hashtag OpenD&D.
I never could have imagined how many people, how many companies. I've never seen anything like that.
A rival game called Pathfinder sold 8 months of product in 2 weeks, according to its CEO. Eventually, Hasbro had to backtrack.
Obviously, it was harmful to the community. And so in that respect, yes, it was a mistake.
Kyle Brink is the executive producer of D&D. Hasbro has now put the game under a Creative Commons license. No royalties attached. Brink has promised future updates to the D&D rulebook will remain open source. Hasbro is in full damage control mode.
I'm sure that there are some people who have left D&D. That being said, it's the common language of all role players. D&D is always going to be there.
There seem to be a bunch of assorted demons and undead here.
It's Friday evening now at Great Escape Games, which means the 20-sided D&D dice are rolling. Kelly Samuelson helps organize games here. She says while she loves D&D, she hasn't felt the love from Hasbro recently.
There's kind of a feeling that we've lost a little bit of the community, and there's a lot more of a push towards monetization.
But she doesn't want to abandon the game entirely, or her characters.
My name is Nadele. I am a elven druid. I am level 20. I've been adventuring for quite some time and faced many powerful foes.
Wonder if she's met Gortham the Barbarian yet. Sounds like they'd hit it off. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today with a quick callback to all the frenzy that surrounded Amazon's search for new headquarters 4 or 5 years ago. HQ2, it came to be called. You remember that? Cities doing all but handing over the keys to lure the giant retailer. Well, be careful what you wish for. Bloomberg broke the story originally that Amazon's taken a pause on construction of its new campus in Arlington, Virginia. The company has committed to spending $2.5 billion and hiring 25,000 people there by 2030. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, more like a moment of common sense, I think. I saw this on Axios, a survey from AAA that shows almost 70% of people say they are afraid of fully self-driving cars. A year ago, that number was 55%. And also, yeah, come on, man. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a good weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.